Welcome, Michael Parenti. Let me first introduce you to the listeners. So in Wikipedia, you're described as an American political scientist, historian, and media critic. And on your own website, your new book, Democracy for the Few, Democracy voor de Elite in the Netherlands, in Dutch, is written that it is a penetrating interpretation of the American political system. It focuses both on formal institutions of government as well as the broad configurations of power, wealth, and class, how the political system is used and controlled for whose benefit and at whose cost. Sounds a bit complicated, but one thing that struck me is that for you, class struggle is not dead.
Oh yes, class struggle is constantly going on. It's always just in the fight for working people to be able to register to vote. In the workplace, the right to be able to go to the washroom, the quality of schools, all of these things, the struggle to get some kind of decent health care for people. The health care system is breaking down terribly. All of that is class struggle and class war, mostly a class war that's perpetrated by the rich and the super rich and the powerful on most of the other the rest of the American population.
So let's get a bit more specific on that. On the one hand, the word in the Dutch version, plutocrat, is that the right word in English?
Yes, it means ruled by the wealthy, the plutocrats.
Yes, well, who are they?
Well, they represent a fraction of 1%. They always you hear 1%. 1% of the American population is 3 million people. It's not 3 million. It's more like 200,000 families or so at most, who make huge amounts of money, and that less than half of 1%, they control the lion's share of the wealth, and they're getting richer and richer as the rest of us are working harder and harder to stay in the same place.
Yeah, when we talk about super rich these days, we think about big managers. But at one point you mentioned they're not really the plutocrats. It's the bosses.
Right. Although in the finance world they do steal or expropriate to them. It's perfectly legal. It's not moral maybe, but they do. The CEOs, they're called chief executive officers of these companies. They take for themselves upwards of 40% of the wealth, and we're talking about a handful of people in each corporation. So in
40% of profit or what?
40% of the earnings, right?
Profits.
So they do take a substantial amount. They represent a component of the super rich.
But they're not. Who is it? Right. It's the owners of the companies then.
In addition, there are the owners, and those are usually the big stockholders. They could be banks. They could be other institutions, which are then owned by other. Individual. But it comes down to certain rich individuals, and that's whom George Bush serves.
Right.
That's really ultimately that's his class, his people, and that's the agenda to make the world safe for the.
No, on the other hand, the working class. We think when we talk working class, we think about people who work in factories, miners. But I think you look at it a bit broader than that.
Yes, I believe anybody who works for a salary, unless you're in management and you're up there, anybody who works for a wage or a salary is working class. Mm-hmm. Even if you work for a public institution like a fireman or whatever of that sort, and those people are exploited. They're exploited as wage owners. They're exploited also as taxpayers. That is, a large chunk of their income is expropriated from them even before they see it. It's called withholding tax. It's taken out of every paycheck every month.
But is that not used for public expenses?
But if your public agenda is very regressive, then it's a form of, you know, it's a form of expropriation. If the money, instead of going for public hospitals and schools and libraries and rebuilding the infrastructure and conservation and environment, if the money it goes into the defense industry, which makes high profits, and or it's just used to service the national debt. That's why I talk about the national debt in the book. How the more conservative presidents have been the biggest spenders, even though they talk about not spending. Yeah. They're the biggest spenders, and the larger the national debt, the greater is that portion of your tax dollar that is being privatized and taken away and not used for public services, but it goes to private creditors. Yeah. So so it's a way of privatizing the federal budget.
Yeah. How do you explain that, that they're the big spenders? Because I remember that after Clinton came to power, then he had to balance the budget, but it was Reagan and Bush Sr. who spent it. So
When Reagan came into office, the national debt was $800 billion. When he left, it was about $2,300 billion. I'm sorry, $800 billion. In other words,
$2 trillion.
And then George Bush Sr. brought it up to almost $5 trillion, and Clinton sort of kept it at that. And then George Jr. now has brought it almost to $10 trillion.
So how do they bring this in line with their ideology of lean government?
They don't. They just ignore that question. They just keep throwing out these slogans and ideologies. But meanwhile, in reality, they are building up an enormous debt, which means they're borrowing money from the people they should be taxing. Those people then, in effect, own that much of the federal budget every year. And the bigger the debt, the bigger the portion that they own. Yeah. And it's an upward transfer of wealth from working people who are taxed to the rich creditors who get this money back.
It's interesting because somewhere you mentioned that a family who earns $60,000 a year pays a higher percentage of taxes than some family who earns $25 million a year.
Right.
How is that possible? I mean, don't you have...
Progressive scale.
Exactly.
The progressive income scale has been blunted. It's very low now.
Yeah.
It's like 20% for the lowest, 25, and then 30, or 35 at most, 30, 35. So it isn't what it used to be. It's graduated tax. So even the very richest person on that first whatever it is, 50,000. They pay the exact same amount that you might pay if that was your total salary.
Right, yeah.
And then they pay more on whatever is above that and more on whatever is above that.
Yeah.
But they have so many deductions, they have so many loopholes that they often... Yeah. Or they get a lot of this money in disguised ways, not in income but in capital gains or in other kinds of services or whatever, you know, from the corporation.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned defense expenses. We've got... What is it? $400 billion now a year expenses?
Oh, it's much more now. It's way over $500 billion.
Okay. There's a couple of things there. First, there's the war cost, which is not included.
Not included.
And you also mentioned 25%, which is kept out of the books. In your book, you mentioned that the budget doesn't contain part of the expenses. How is that possible?
There's what's called. There's what's called off budget, so a lot of the money that comes in doesn't even make it into the regular budget. One of the big items on the off budget is the $500 billion payoff for the savings and loan banks that crashed and all that.
Yeah.
And and now we see another $700 billion going off to this financial class.
Okay, we'll talk about it in a minute. Yeah. Because and at the beginning of your book, you mention a couple of... perceptions of U.S. democracy, which then you gradually break down. One of them that is that the U.S. democracy is based on the Constitution. Secondly, it's based on democratic elections. Then it's society of socioeconomic groups that keep each other in balance. And then four, the government has limited powers. You mentioned one or two chapters on the Constitution, which is perceived as egalitarian? You say it's not egalitarian.
Yes, a close reading of the Constitution and the people who wrote it back in 1787 shows that it was really intended to stabilize the country and to keep to keep the mass of people in line, and you can give them a little bit to keep a lot. And it was the goal was to have a stabilized currency, to have a federal government that had the power to tax so it could build an army, to protect property owners and the like.
But to some extent, aren't those things that are necessary, like financial, at least one currency?
Some of those things, most definitely are not only necessary, they're necessary. But
so where is it not to what you think it should be?
Well, for instance, a relatively small portion of the population was allowed to vote.
Mm-hmm.
There were property qualifications on all the voters. There were property qualifications for holding office in various states. There was slavery, and the slave interests were thoroughly accommodated.
Yeah.
There was a whole system of vetoes against any kind of mass democratic swelling. There were all these kind of locks,
right,
you know, to prevent a real democratic flood. And the comments of these delegates to the Philadelphia Convention that wrote the Constitution, they're very clear in their distrust and dislike of democracy. They really didn't. They wanted to avoid the excesses. The president is not directly elected.
So they allowed a little bit of democracy.
Right. There was no direct election of the president. The president was elected by an electoral college, which was picked often by state legislators or county sheriffs.
Yep.
So it was much removed. In fact, there still isn't a direct election of a president.
Yep.
The Senate was picked and by the various state legislators. The Supreme Court was appointed by the president. They weren't elected, and they had these powers to review laws and overthrow laws and the like.
Yeah. Of course, this was 1787.
Right. Yeah.
So in Europe, in France, they still had the Louis XVI.
That's right.
Has it improved since then, or is it?
Has it improved since Louis XVI?
The French, in France it has, but I mean the Constitution, is it?
Well, yeah, the Constitution's gotten more democratized. We have direct elections of the Senate now. The election of the Electoral College is much more direct from primary, from votes, rather than from intervening politicians.
So is it just a matter of interpretation of the Constitution, where still things are not?
The Constitution is still very hard to work with in terms of trying to get really fundamental change. There's still so many different hurdles you got to go through, the House and the Senate, and that's not necessarily the Constitution only. It's also the distribution of power and the influence over the whole political process the plutocracy exercises.
Yeah, you also say that, well, we have the elections, the other element of democracy.
Right.
Let's talk about those. Aren't they, sometimes it's the biggest democracy of the world, the U.S. Well, not accounting for India then, but you don't agree with that, do you?
The struggle for the vote has been a terrible and serious struggle, and it still goes on today. The struggle was to get white workers the right to vote and to abolish property qualifications for voting. The struggle for women to get the vote took 100 years. The struggle for black people of both genders to get the vote, of course, it took a struggle to give them liberty, and then another almost 100 years before we broke segregation and now black people vote in substantial numbers. But even today, there are still struggles. There are ways of suppressing the vote that are being used. For instance, demanding that everybody who comes to the polls have a two-picture IDs, you know. And there are a lot of older, poorer people don't have a driver's license with a picture ID. They don't have a birth certificate, or you have to show proof of birth. So they're making it difficult again. They're doing these things. And in addition, you have these very strange electronic voting, which we know could be open very much to manipulation of votes. And I write about that, the two stolen presidential elections that we've had. So democracy is really very seriously imperiled in America today.
Yeah, you mentioned the fraud in 2000, but also 2004.
Yes,
can you talk about that?
2004, there was substantial fraud that in the Wherever there were irregularities, they all went in George Bush's favor. For instance, in a county which had only 600 voters, George Bush got 2,000 votes.
Yeah.
The mistakes never went in his opponent's favor. Yeah. Maybe the best example is New Mexico. In New Mexico, Kerry lost every county that he lost was a county that had a touch screen, regardless of the ethnic background, the income level, or past voting behavior of the county. The only thing it correlated with was the existence of that voting screen, and he lost all of those.
Now, the Democrats are not a revolutionary party. They're also part of the system. So is that a logic that elite would favoritize one party if both are part of the system?
It is true there are some very rich people. It is true that there are some very rich people who contribute to both parties. After all, why own only one party when you can own two parties, both parties?
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is there is a very concerted effort to abolish liberalism, to exclude liberalism from the agenda, to get rid of social democracy. Mm-hmm. And they've been very successful at doing it. Whatever little social democracy we had been developing, you know, by the mid-70s, the ruling elites, and I have quotes in one of my books where they said, "We're moving toward a social democracy. We've got to do something about this and stop it." And just a couple of weeks ago, I saw an article in the New Yorker where one of the top officials of the Republican National Committee said, "We're running out of issues because we've succeeded in everything. We've destroyed the social democracy."
Yeah.
And they pretty much rolled it back, except for retirement pensions. That's the only thing they have. They're trying to privatize that, too.
And yeah, because the elite, you say, they try to say that the public health care is bad, but you say, first, there is a system in place, which in Europe most people don't know. And secondo, it works.
Could you talk here, about you that? Mean in Western
Well, Europe? No, in the U.S., there's a limited health care. So I think that's what you were referring to earlier. For pensioners and
We call it Social Security, but that means more here in Europe than it's a capital S in both. Social Security is a particular program, and it's retirement, it's disability, and it's survivor's insurance too. If children in a family where the breadwinner dies or something, they get support until they're 18.
Okay.
But now Bush has tried to get rid of those things, but he hasn't been that successful. He's defunded. What they do is they nibble away, they drain from different programs, environmental programs, other kind of programs.
Yeah.
They drain away money and they've been very successful at that.
We almost have to leave it there. I want to. Two more points, of course, is the first, Obama. What do you think of him?
I think he's not as bad as McCain, but but he's not somebody I think is going to really be able to make the deep changes that America will need.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be able to. We need a mass movement that demands real changes.
Dennis Kucinich, one of the eight candidates for the Democratic presidency.
Dennis Kucinich is a genuine progressive who wanted to make fundamental changes in the country.
Yeah,
it would have been a much better and decent country if Kucinich was president and if Congress and the courts were all populated by people who think like him.
Because he's a Democrat. He's not the Green Party, not independent.
He is a Democrat, but there isn't a Democratic Party, a progressive caucus.
Okay.
There's about 80 members in the House, you know, and a few in the Senate. And so there's progressive caucus, which is better than the usual centrist Democrat.
And then the financial collapse. What are your main comments on Paulson's $700 billion?
It's a blackmail. It's a form of blackmail. They've turned this disaster into stealing $700 billion from the American people, and they're not doing anything with it. Last week, when they wanted the money, they said, if we don't get this money, credit's going to dry up, there'll be increased unemployment, businesses will close down, there'll be less jobs, but it'll be a disaster, it'll go into a free fall. They got the money instantly, you know, George Bush signed it within hours, and then this morning I'm just hearing these commentators, and they're saying, there's a problem, credit's drying up, unemployment, jobs are dropped. No mention that they got all this money. Well, isn't this money supposed to prevent those things from happening. Yeah. That money should have gone, in fact, to small businesses, to small farmers, to working families who would spend it, who could use it, to people who to get their mortgages back and get their homes back. That would have helped the economy.
That should have helped invested in the mortgage takers rather than the banks.
Exactly. Yeah. Not the thieves, but the victims should have been helped. Yeah. And the money, if the system needs pump priming, you should pump it in at the bottom, not at the top. Those people have plenty of capital, plenty of money. Uh-huh. They just didn't want to invest anymore because things look so chancy and so, yeah. so you know, scandalous.
Okay. I think we'll have to leave you there. Okay. Thank you, Michael Parenti.
Thank you.